Lecture 8, Trademark.
Greetings. This topic is trademark, interference with trademark. Trademark started out as a tort, much like the other torts we've talked about. And misappropriation, trademark is one of the things you could misappropriate. Trademark since has been encapsulated by a statute, a federal law that protects your trademark. But in many ways, it still works like a tort in terms of liability, and it's an important issue to business. You have some idea what a trademark is, I think. Coca-Cola, of course, is a trademark. And trademarks have value to business. Trademarks are very important to the goodwill of business. If Coca-Cola sold exactly the same product, but without the Coca-Cola name, it would sell a lot less. And if somebody else sold a different product, but with the Coca-Cola name, it would sell a lot more. So trademarks are important, and business needs to protect their trademarks, and the law enables them to do so, not without limit, though. So we're going to be talking about trademark here. And the first thing you have to have a trademark suit, is to have a protectable trademark. Your trademark must be a protectable one. Well, why are some trademarks protectable and not others? What's the problem here? Well, I'll tell you why. Some trademarks are not protectable. The first thing we have to do is talk about the categories of trademarks. There are several categories of possible trademarks: generic, descriptive, and suggestive or fanciful. Generic, descriptive, suggestive, or fanciful. Now, generic trademarks are those that are not protectable. Generic trademarks are not protectable. Well, what's a generic trademark? Well, how about aspirin? Did you ever wonder why aspirin was called aspirin? Maybe not. No reason you should. But aspirin is not a name that specifically describes that little pill. That little pill is something that I understand is called acetyl salicylic acid. So why did acetyl salicylic acid, why is it called aspirin? Well, somebody way back when, in fact, I think it was a Mr. Bayer, to tell you the truth, made the first pain reliever out of acetyl salicylic acid, and somehow he dreamed up the name aspirin to call it. Well, that was pretty good. But a problem arose. Mr. Bayer lost his trademark. Everybody started calling acetyl salicylic acid aspirin. Even acetyl salicylic acid tablets that were made by other people started being called aspirin. So he lost his trademark. It became generic. The word aspirin became the name for this pill. Not the name for his brand of this pill, but the name for his pill generally. There are a lot of other examples. Thermos. Have you ever asked for a thermos of coffee or soup? Did you ever wonder why an insulated bottle was called a thermos? The reason an insulated bottle is called a thermos is because the thermos company invented the first one. But when people started wanting to buy insulated bottles, because the thermos company was the first one, they wouldn't go into a store and ask for an insulated bottle. They'd go in and ask for a thermos. So it soon became known that the word for this type of bottle was thermos. And because thermos described the product instead of the manufacturer, it was lost. It became generic. What about some others? Trampoline. Trampoline was once a brand name, a trademark that was lost. Escalator, likewise. Linoleum. There's a debate over Kleenex and Band-Aid. I'm not sure if those have become generic or not. But think about it. If you hurt yourself, if you have a boo-boo, do you say, "Mommy, Mommy, I want an adhesive bandage strip"? Probably not. Say, "Mommy, Mommy, I want a Band-Aid." And to the extent that's true, it becomes generic. Some companies have taken great pains to protect their trademark and keep it from becoming generic. You know, the company Xerox, of course, at one point was a leading manufacturer of photocopiers, and people started referring to that process as Xeroxing. Xerox this for me. Get me some Xeroxes. Well, the Xerox company saw that it was in danger of losing its trademark protection, of becoming generic. So it actually took out ads and said, "This isn't a Xerox, this is a photocopy. Call it a photocopy." And then they lost most of their market share in this anyway, so. Or Coca-Cola. I don't know where you're from, but a carbonated drink, what do you call it where you're from? Some places they call it a soda, some places they call it a pop. In the South, at least where I'm around, in Texas, people call it Cokes. They call all sodas Cokes. Now they say, "Let's go get some Cokes." And, you know, they're talking about 7-Up or Mountain Dew or something, but they call it a Coke. Well, Coca-Cola has some concern about that, losing its trademark. And Coca-Cola has actually sent people around to restaurants ordering Cokes. These are people with, you know, good taste testers. They order a Coke, and if they're given a Pepsi or some other product, you know, they may even sue the restaurant. So generic, you have to be careful that your trademark does not become generic, because if it is a generic trademark, you cannot be protected. And I'm talking mainly about trademarks that were once good and became generic, but you could start off with a generic trademark. For example, you might sell clocks under the name Clock, brand Clocks. Could you get a trademark in the word clock to sell clocks? No, because that's just what the product is. So generic trademarks are not protected at all. The second category of trademarks are descriptive trademarks. These do not define the product, but they describe the product. For example, Newsweek magazine. What is Newsweek magazine? It is a magazine of news that comes out every week. That describes the product. Can you have a protected descriptive trademark? Well, you can. It's not quite so easy. You may have to show what is called a secondary meaning. That is, you may need to show that the term Newsweek has in the public mind a meaning different from just a magazine with the week's news, but has in mind a specific magazine. And of course it does. When you talk about getting a Newsweek, you're not talking about getting any weekly news magazine. You're talking about getting a specific magazine. Descriptive trademark. What if you want to sell something called Cool Menthol Lozenges? Can you get a trademark in Cool Menthol Lozenges? Well, that really just describes the product. So you would have to show that people associate that name, Cool Menthol Lozenges, with your specific product, and not just with the general throat lozenges that, you know, have a menthol taste. Now, the third category, or third and fourth of trademarks, are suggestive or fanciful. Suggestive or fanciful. These are names that really have nothing to do with the product itself. I mean, Xerox is that. Until, you know, they started producing these machines, there was no, Xerox was not a word as far as I'm aware of. So it was fanciful. Kodak. Kodak's a good example. You know, Kodak cameras. There's nothing about the word Kodak that's associated with the idea of a camera. So those are definitely protected. You can definitely have a suggestive or a fanciful trademark and have it be protected. And the law has several reasons here. I mean, one is to avoid confusion, but one is also to enable people to have sufficient names for their product. If you are allowed to get a trademark in clock brand clocks, it would make it much more difficult for other clock makers to describe their product. But giving you a trademark in Kodak cameras, that doesn't restrict other people at all. If they want to make cameras, there's no reason they would want to use the word Kodak. They can use some other word, like Polaroid. So suggestive or fanciful trademarks are the most likely best protectable trademarks. So those categories you have to look to when you're deciding whether a trademark is protectable. But there's a second condition on whether a trademark is protectable, and that is that a trademark cannot be illegal or immoral and be protected. Wait a minute, why would that happen? Why would a trademark be illegal or immoral? It doesn't happen very often, but I'm aware of two fried chicken cases where it did happen. One company was trying to sell fried chicken, and they wanted to trademark the phrase, "The only thing better than our leg in your hand is our breast in your mouth." That was held to be a little too immoral to be a trademark. Another fried chicken place, and I think this was Mickey Mantle's fried chicken, Mickey, wanted to trademark the phrase, "The only way to get a better piece of chicken is if you're a rooster." That, too, was held to be inappropriate and immoral. Well, those don't happen very often. But there are some other things that, illegal, immoral, but at any rate, they're not allowed to be trademarked. You cannot be misdescriptive. You cannot have a misdescriptive trademark. Remember, I told you how you could have a descriptive trademark that might be protected, but you can't even get a misdescriptive trademark. Somebody wanted to get a trademark in a glass polishing substance, you know, waxing substance or whatever, but they wanted to call it glass wax. But they were not allowed to call it glass wax because the product had no wax in it. To call something glass wax, it's got to have wax in it. There was another company that, you know, wanted to sell perfume called Made in Paris perfume. But it wasn't made in Paris. I mean, it was made in New Jersey or someplace like that. So they couldn't get a trademark in that. That was misdescriptive. It was a lie. You can't get a trademark in that. Now, of course, you can sort of hint misdescriptively. You know, Häagen-Dazs ice cream, you know, I'm sure you heard about that. When Häagen-Dazs ice cream was invented by a couple of Americans from somewhere, like New Jersey, I don't know where. You know, they wanted to sell a real premium ice cream, and they tried to, you know, think, what would a real premium, what do we want? They decided that making it sound cold and Danish would be, you know, a good way to sell ice cream. So they made up this word, Häagen-Dazs, which is not a Danish word to the best of my knowledge. And that's okay. It doesn't say it's Danish. I mean, it might lead you to think that, but it doesn't say it is. So that's okay. So it can't be illegal or immoral. What about registration? You may have heard that trademarks can be registered. And in fact, there is a federal bureau called the PTO, the Patent and Trademark Office, and you can register your trademark, which seems like a good thing. If you want to protect your trademark, you want to register, right? You don't have to. In part because trademarks start off as just a common law tort cause of action, you don't have to register your trademark to have it be protected. All you have to do to have your trademark be protected is to have it be protectable and to use it. To use it. However, there are some good reasons to register. If you register your trademark is good throughout the entire nation, the good old US of A from Maine to Alaska. If you don't register your trademark, it is only usable in the geographic area where you sell it. So if you don't register your trademark and you only sell in Texas, somebody else can take that trademark and sell it in Oklahoma, Louisiana, New York, wherever. Another thing is, if your trademark is registered, it has to go through an approval process in the Patent and Trademark Office. And once it gets that approval, you have a presumption of its validity. It's presumed valid, which makes it harder for someone to come along and try and reuse your trademark and claim it was invalid in the first place. It has a presumption of validity once it passes the Patent and Trademark Office. Note that a trademark can be lost by abandonment. You have a trademark protected. You stop using it. You can lose your right to your trademark if you don't use it. Use it or lose it. There was a recent case of this. There were the Brooklyn Dodgers first, and they moved and became the Los Angeles Dodgers. And somebody wanted to open a bar called the Brooklyn Dodger. And the Los Angeles Dodgers sued them, well, on several grounds, but one of them was a violation of their trademark. And the court said this was not a violation of their trademark because the Los Angeles Dodgers had lost the trademark in Brooklyn Dodgers by abandonment. They hadn't used it. Well, that's not what they're called anymore. Of course they hadn't used it, but because they hadn't used it, they'd abandoned it and they lost the right. Here's an example of the need to register. There was a little, pretty nice, good salsa outfit in Austin that produced a salsa called Del Rio, I think, or something like that. And they had a nice little business in the Austin area and not too far away from there. Well, a big national company decided it wanted to produce Del Rio salsa too. Ordinarily, that would be a terrible trademark violation. Except the Austin company had not registered and only sold in this little area. So the national company moved in and started selling their salsa in San Antonio and other parts of Texas where the little Austin company hadn't gone. Well, that was legal because the failure to register it meant that the trademark was only protected in the areas of geographic use. That was, you know, naturally a big problem for the poor little Austin company. They had to change their name because all of the areas where they would have liked to expand were already lost to this other company. So registration is a valuable good thing. You should do it. If you don't, you have some protection, but it's still generally better to do it. Okay, I want to talk about one more other was that may be protectable, and that is what's called trade dress. Trade dress. So far, when we've talked about trademark, we've talked about words. Words that describe a product. But what about the appearance of the product? The shape of the package? Is that protectable? Can that be trademarked? Sure it can. An early classic case was the Pinch Scotch bottle. I don't know if you had any Pinch Scotch. I've had a little in my time. It had a very distinctive shaped little stubby bottle. And it was held that that was protected and somebody else could not come along and sell scotch in that same size bottle. That would You know, that would be a violation of their trademark, because some people, you know, don't look at the label carefully. They just go over there, they see the shape of the bottle, they think, oh yeah, that's, they grab that, and so they're infringing on Pinch's trademark. Here was an interesting controversy that the law still hasn't quite settled. Can you get a trademark in a color? Can you get a trademark in a color for your product? Should you? There was a case that said yes. People making insulation, you know, insulation in the attic and all that. Well, one of the insulation manufacturers dyes its product a rather bright pink color. And some of their competitors wanted to use that same pink color. And the original manufacturer said, no, you can't do that. Can't do that. Pink is trademarked to us. And the second user, Scott, says, you can't trademark a color. There are only so many colors. The court said, yes, you can. Said they can trademark that color. But it's not entirely consistent. Because those little sugar substitute packages, I don't use them, but, you know, they seem to be kind of color-coded. There's one that's equal or something like that that's blue. Well, somebody else wanted to produce a package of sugar substitute that was blue, and the manufacturers of the pre-existing blue one sued and said, hey, they're infringing on our trademark. They're taking our color blue. But in that case, the ruling was no. You couldn't trademark the color blue for a little sugar package. And I'm not sure there's a really carefully, rigorously disciplined explanation of what the difference is. But I think courts are going to be a little reluctant to let you trademark a color because there are, after all, only so many colors. And you're going to start seriously infringing upon other people's ability to market their products if you start trademarking the colors. I mean, first the primary colors will be all taken, right? Then the secondary colors, and then people are going to have to start going to weird little shades. And so trade dress can be trademarked. Color is still a bit up in the air. But that's only the first requirement to have trademark protection, that being a protectable trademark. You also have to show that there is a likelihood of confusion. You have to show that another person using your trademark creates a likelihood of confusion between your products. That you're afraid that that other person is going to pass off his or her products as yours and cost you business. So there has to be a likelihood of confusion. And what that generally means is that if the products are very different, there's no problem. There's no likelihood of confusion if the products are very different. If you this is a reason why lots of different companies call themselves Acme. You look in your phone book, you're going to find a lot of Acme, this, that, and the other things. Do you ever wonder, well, aren't they all infringing on somebody as trademark? Who was first? Well, it's not a problem because they're not in competitive fields. Somebody wants to rent an Acme truck, you know, they're not going to, instead of renting a truck, buy some Acme bathroom tissue. There's no likelihood of confusion there. They're completely different products. So when you're deciding on the likelihood of confusion, one of the first keys is competing goods. There's not likely to be much confusion unless the goods are in competition. I'm not going to lose business to somebody using my trademark unless our goods are in competition. Well, how do you decide if they're in competition? Well, I mean, one thing is you look at whether you're likely to buy one instead of the other. Obviously, if there are two brands of bathroom tissue, you know, there's going to be a trade-off. What if there are two brands of soft drink? There's going to be a trade-off. What if one's a brand of soft drink and one's a brand of liquor? Well, then maybe not. They're not in competition. Maybe they are, maybe they're not in competition. It's not such a clear trade-off. One of the things you look to is user sophistication. User sophistication. The likelihood of confusion on competing goods depends on how sophisticated the buyer is and how closely they're going to look at that product to make sure it's the same or a different product. There have been some geographic issues here. For example, with restaurant names. There's a famous restaurant in New York City called Lutece. What if I wanted to open up a Lutece in Abilene, Texas? Could I do so? Traditionally, the answer was sure I could. There's not going to be any confusion, I promise, between the Lutece in New York City and the Lutece in Abilene. What's more, you're not likely to even be competing for the same customers for the most part. Most people, you know, New Yorkers aren't going to say, well, instead of going down to such and such a street tonight, why don't we fly to Abilene, Texas and go and eat at that? You're not going to have that problem. Of course, there are an increasing number of nationwide restaurant chains now, and some of those chains are fairly upscale, nice restaurants. That may change the situation a little bit. If somebody's got a national chain of restaurants and you open up one up with that same name but you're unaffiliated with the chain, there might be a real likelihood of confusion there. There might be an authentic problem, especially if your restaurant is, you know, somehow like the other one. So you look at competing goods, and you look at geographically. A second thing you look to is the similarity, the actual similarity of the product. Now, if it's an exact copy, that makes the case very easy. Right? If I'm producing Acme bathroom tissue and somebody else produces Acme bathroom tissue, that's pretty easy. That's clear. But what if the competitor, instead of producing Acme bathroom tissue, produces Acme Y bathroom tissue? That's a little different. How much? You look at the amount of similarity, how close they are. And what do you look when you're looking at similarity? Well, you look at if they sound alike. You look if they sound alike. There was a big case between Lexus, L-E-X-U-S, the car manufacturer, and Lexus, L-E-X-I-S, a computer database. And they called all these linguistic experts. And one side said they're pronounced exactly alike. Lexus, Lexus. Other side says, no, there's a big difference between the I and the U. Lexus, Lexus. You know, so one thing is, do they sound alike? But there can be a lot of similarity, even if they don't sound alike. How could that be? Consider this example. There was a case about, you know, there's a fencing company called Cyclone Fences, right? A competitor wanted to start up a similar type of wire fencing and called themselves Tornado Fences. Well, that doesn't sound alike, but there's obviously a likelihood of confusion there. I mean, Cyclone and Tornado are two names for roughly the same thing. So that's a great deal of similarity, even though they don't sound alike. There's a similar case with furniture waxes. You've heard maybe of Pledge Furniture Wax. Somebody wanted to produce a product called Promise Furniture Wax. You know, again, quite similar. Which is a third thing you look to, and that is the intent of the junior user. The intent of the junior, who's the junior user? Well, the junior user is the second one. And in the, I don't know the facts, but I would say that if I were going to go out and produce Tornado wire fences, my intent is not pure. I did not pick the word tornado because I love tornadoes. It looks pretty likely that I picked the word tornado because I think I can steal some of the goodwill of Cyclone. There's one case where a fellow, you know, Sears, the big department store, had something called Sears Financial Services, where you walk into the department store, buy a pair of shoes, and make some investments. Well, this fellow wanted to start up his own company called Sears Investment Services or something like that. Well, Sears wasn't his name. They said, why do you want to start up Sears Investment Services? He said, well, in high school, I was really in love with this woman, and her name was Sears, and I wanted to call myself Sears Investment Services in tribute to her, and the court said, yeah, right, tell us another one. We think you have bad faith. We think you're trying to steal the goodwill of the first user, so you lose. Now, another factor in similarity, which is kind of important, is called bridging the gap. Bridging the gap. This is where, remember I talked about how similarity, it's important that the goods be competing. But bridging the gap is a case where there may be a likelihood of confusion and a trademark infringement, even where the goods are not directly competing. If it looks like the first user is likely to want to expand into that second product that the second user is doing. And the classic case here is Yale Lux. You may have heard of Yale Lux. It's a very well-known and well-respected manufacturer of Lux. Well, someone else wanted to start producing other hardware and calling it Yale. Yale screwdrivers, something like that. Well, the Yale Lux people sued. The second user said there's no likelihood of confusion here because there's no cross-elasticity, there's no trade-off between a lock and a screwdriver. If you need a lock, you don't want a screwdriver and vice versa. But the court held that could be an infringement on the trademark because of bridging the gap. A logical area of expansion, Yale Lux argued it was an area of expansion, was they were going to expand from locks into other related hardware sold in similar places by, you know, similar retail outlets. So that is bridging the gap because they could indicate that they were likely to want to expand into that area. That, there could be a likelihood of confusion there. And the last thing specific to trademark I want to talk about is the parody defense, making fun of. Because of the First Amendment, you know, is affected a little bit in trademark. People, you know, have some free speech rights. They don't have the free speech to steal other people's goodwill, but it's affected somewhat. And there are some people who do parodies. For example, I think it was the National Lampoon people or someone put out a magazine called Not the New York Times. An issue It was supposed to look exactly like the New York Times, except it was making fun of the New York Times, and it said not the New York Times at the top and had all these articles, you know, blah, blah. Well, it did kind of look like the New York Times, and I know some people who, you know, sort of picked it up by accident, you know, thinking it was the New York Times. They didn't read it closely to see it said not the New York Times. It was very funny, too, by the way. Did that infringe on the New York Times? No. That was a parody. They weren't attempting to use the goodwill of the New York Times. They were attempting to make fun of it. And if somebody bought this paper by mistake instead of the New York Times, this paper still did not substitute for the New York Times. I suspect if they wanted a New York Times, they went back and bought a real one later. So this parody defense exists. Okay, that's trademark, but I want to talk about a little spin-off to trademark that's a bit broader, and those are called anti-dilution laws. This is not a federal law, but this is a state law. It is an anti-dilution law that protects trademarks even where there's no likelihood of confusion. In other words, these state laws protect trademarks not just from passing off of other companies, of the products of other companies, but also from things that might not be confused with your trademark, but might hurt its reputation. You know, arguably, the New York Times could argue that the not the New York Times parody, you know, hurt its reputation somehow. The anti-dilution laws protect against two separate additional things beyond trademark law. The first one is they protect against tarnishment of your trademark. Tarnishment of your trademark. How would your trademark be tarnished? Well, your trademark might be tarnished by associating your trademark with some sort of unsavory practice. There was an example. Coca-Cola, of course, has a well-known trademark with a well-known wave and a well-known red color and even a well-known type of lettering. And I think they may have had some advertisements that just said, "Enjoy Coca-Cola." Well, somebody wanted to produce a poster, well, did produce a poster, that said, "Enjoy cocaine." This was, you know, back when drugs weren't so considered as bad as they are today. "Enjoy cocaine." And it used that same trademark of Coke, color, wave, same lettering, but it said, "Enjoy cocaine" instead of "Enjoy Coca-Cola." Coca-Cola won under the anti-dilution laws, successfully arguing that that tarnished Coke's trademark by associating it with the unsavory and the improper activity of drug taking. Another tarnishment win was the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, pretty famous group. Well, there was this X-rated movie made called Debbie Does Dallas. And a point of this movie, I guess, was that this woman became a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader and engaged in all sorts of inappropriate activities in the course of so doing. Well, and I think she had a uniform that was very much like the Dallas Cowboy cheerleader uniform in her role in the movie. And the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, who strive very hard to maintain a very pristine image, sued the makers of this movie, saying that tarnished their trademark, you know, the association of their little uniform and all that. And they won. They won. That movie was held to have tarnished their trademark. However, most of these anti-dilution cases do not win. Most of these, even the tarnishment cases, don't win. Somebody once produced something called L.L. Bean's Back to School Sex Catalog. And it was a parody. It was a parody of L.L. Bean. You know, it showed these people in all these classic L.L. Bean out in the woods of Maine in their duck shoes and all that sort of thing, doing all sorts of questionable things, sex-related things. And L.L. Bean sued, saying that tarnishes our reputation. And you might think they had some sort of claim, but the court said, no, this is a parody. It's all in good fun. You can't sue for that. Another big tarnishment case was a product called Lardash Jeans. Now, you may have heard of Jordache jeans. Jordache jeans became very well known, got a good reputation. They were jeans that, you know, were supposed to be very sexy and you know, very slender models and very tight jeans, right? Well, some people in New Mexico got a clever idea. They were going to make something called Lardash jeans. And these jeans were going to be in large sizes for bigger women. And Jordache didn't like this. And they sued Lardash both for trademark and for anti-dilution. Well, Jordache lost the trademark claim because there was no likelihood of confusion, for one thing. I mean, Jordache is very protected, fanciful trademark, but there was no likelihood of confusion, and it was a parody. And the jeans weren't even in the same sizes, so in some ways they weren't even competing. What about tarnishment? There it might seem that Jordache had a little better claim. I mean, the largest people were kind of making fun of them and all that, but the court said, no, this doesn't really tarnish the Jordache trademark. I mean, there's enough difference between Lardash and Jordache, and we don't think, you know, big sizes is all that unsavory anyway, so they lost that case. So tarnishment is one of the things the anti-dilution laws protect against. Another thing the anti-dilution laws protect against is loss of uniqueness. Loss of uniqueness. If you have a very fanciful trademark that is unique, nobody else in the entire United States uses this trademark, then a second user, even a savory one, might be able to be sued by you for anti-dilution, because you're losing the uniqueness of your trademark if you're the only one to use it. There aren't many cases of this because there are so many companies out there, there aren't many unique trademarks around, but that's another possibility. Okay, let's go to the cases. Let's talk about some cases. Here's an interesting one. The Hard Rock Cafe, you've probably heard of it. They wanted to sell a product called a pig sandwich. Pig sandwich. It happened that there was already an outfit, though, called the Texas Pig Stands. This was Texas Pig Stands, that already sold pig sandwiches. So do you think pig sandwich is a protectable trademark? There's an argument, no, it's not, of course. Pig sandwich is totally descriptive. It's a sandwich made from a pig. But the court said that this pig sandwich was well enough known that it had a secondary meaning. That at least in some parts of the country, pig sandwich, you know, was associated with this specific product from this specific maker, the Texas Pig Stands. So the court said because of that secondary meaning, it is a protectable trademark. And the Texas Pig Stands successfully got an injunction against the Hard Rock Cafe, preventing them from calling their product a pig sandwich. How about a case that did come out that way? There was a British company that produced a magazine called Marketing Week. And there was a U.S. company that produced a magazine called Ad Week. And these were roughly in the same area. They summarized the world of advertising and marketing for that week. Well, the U.S. company decided to put out a new product called Adweek's Marketing Week. But Marketing Week was pretty much the same name, was exactly the same name as the British Marketing Week. And while it was called Adweek's Marketing Week, it was one of those things where Adweek, you know, was in little letters and Marketing Week was in big letters. So it was argued a trademark infringement case was brought here. Well, what do you think? Do you think it is a protectable trademark? Marketing Week. Well, it's descriptive, right? It's descriptive just like pig sandwich is descriptive. But the court found that it had acquired a secondary meaning, just like Newsweek has acquired a secondary meaning. The term Marketing Week was associated with this particular company's product. Then the court went through and looked at all the standards for whether there was a likelihood of confusion. The two magazines looked rather alike. They had exactly the same title. And the court also decided that the junior user, Adweek, may not have used good faith in this case. And because of that, the court said, we think there is a likelihood of confusion here. Therefore, Adweek's Marketing Week was an infringement on the trademark. Now, of course, there are a variety of things that can be trademarked, trade dress. And there was a trade dress case involving Vuitton handbags. Nice, fancy French handbags that are pretty expensive, as a general rule. Now, these Vuitton handbags don't say Vuitton in big letters on them, to the best of my knowledge. But they are characterized by a specific design. This design has interlocking initials of, I think it's LV for Louis Vuitton. And then it has fleur-de-lis all over it. Well, a U.S. competitor wanted to, you know, get in on the success of Vuitton handbags. So it made a much cheaper product that had a very similar look. It had fleur-de-lis all over it. And while I don't think it had an LV, it had a funny little design that looked kind of like an LV. So the court said, that's a trademark infringement. But this trade dress can be kind of tricky. I don't know if you know about Hermès ties. Hermès ties were very hot, especially in the 80s. This was a French maker of men's ties, and their ties had some rather characteristic patterns. One of the characteristic pattern on the tie was sort of chains or linking things all the way down. But these became so popular and hot that they inspired a lot of knockoffs of the design. Other people with chains and linking things all the way down their ties. They weren't exactly the same pattern as any of the Hermès, of course, but they had sort of the same theme of fairly detailed little pictures of linking chains. Do you think that should be a trademark violation? I'm not aware of any case here, but I'd suspect no. I think the idea of a small print of linking things is a little bit too broad to let you trademark it. And I assume it's not a trademark violation because these people continue to sell these things and Hermès has not been able to stop them. However, if somebody did an exact copy of a well-known print of an Hermès tie, that might well be considered a trademark violation. Okay, at this point I'd like to talk about some anti-dilution cases because they're kind of funny. Some of them are kind of funny. You may know of a product sold by manufacturers of tea. You like a nice cup of tea? There are Tetley tea bags. You can get some Tetley tea bags. Well, somebody decided to make a product for animals and call it Petley flea bags. Petley flea bags. Now, is there a trademark violation there? No, not really. If you want a cup of tea, you're not going to buy a flea bag. So there's not much likelihood of confusion there. But what about tarnishment? Tetley tea bags argued, this tarnishes us by associating us to flea bags. The court said no. Flea bags are not exactly unsavory, we don't think. We don't think this is a tarnishment of your product. There was a case in Texas that, to the best of my knowledge, never got resolved. But you may be aware of the Stealth Airplane. One of these big companies, I don't even know if it's McDonnell Douglas or Northrop or whoever, made the Stealth Airplane, right? Great famous airplane. Well, a little company decided to start making stealth condoms. Stealth condoms. And the airplane company made all these threatening noises about bringing a lawsuit. But I don't know if they ever did. I don't think it was ever decided. But that would be an anti-dilution case. That would not be a trademark case because there's not much competition between giant multi-million dollar airplanes and condoms. But there's a possible dilution case there if you argued that condom was somehow unsavory. I'm not sure you could in this day and age, but that would be a partial anti-dilution case. Okay, let me tell you one that was decided. The Girl Scouts, you know, have the motto of be prepared. And someone once published a poster of a pregnant girl, you know, a fairly young girl who was obviously pregnant, very pregnant. And this pregnant girl was wearing a Girl Scout uniform, and it said, be prepared, at the bottom. And the Girl Scouts did not like that, and they sued for tarnishment. I don't think they had a hopeless case, but the court said they lost. I mean, that's not too unlike the enjoy cocaine thing. Except it seems in a little bit better spirit, you know, fun-spirited parody. So that was okay. That was not a tarnishment. The Cabbage Patch Dolls, of course, were very popular for a while. And some people started producing little stickers of the Garbage Pail Kids. And these Garbage Pail Kids stickers, which you may be familiar with, had all sorts of gross names and pictures on them, like Puking Paul or something like that. And the Cabbage Patch Doll, I mean, Garbage Pail Kids doesn't even sound that much like Cabbage Patch Dolls, I don't think. But the Cabbage Patch Dolls people thought they were, you know, infringing on stealing their trademark. And so they sued for dilution. But they lost. Not enough. Well, let me give you one that won. You may or may not have heard of Two Live Crew. Two Live Crew has been in the news intermittently because their raps are pretty suggestive of violence. Gangster rap, you know, supposedly encourages violence in shooting policemen. And one of the main men in Two Live Crew is a fellow named Luther Campbell. But he did not originally go by his name, Luther Campbell. He originally wanted to go by Luke Skywalker. Well, Luke Skywalker, of course, was the name of a character in the Star Wars movies. So they sued, I assume the owner of whoever the owner of the Star Wars movies is, sued Two Life Crew and Luther Campbell under tarnishment. There's no confusion, but under tarnishment, saying that, you know, associating the name Luke Skywalker with this type of rap music will tarnish the reputation of. And they won. And, you know, these should be a little bit surprising to you. I don't think there's a real clear-cut basis for explaining why some won and some lost. I mean, most of these are sort of debatable, could go either way, I think. So I can't, you know, consequently can't make you any guarantees about the law in any specific example. But just be aware that there is this tarnishment problem, and if your business is considered an unsavory one, you maybe shouldn't go around parodying well-respected businesses. Okay, what about a couple more trademark cases? I told you about the Here's Johnny portable toilets, right? And I told you that Johnny Carson won that case for invasion of privacy. As it happened, Johnny Carson not only alleged invasion of privacy by misappropriation of likeness in that case, he also alleged a trademark violation. A trademark violation. Here's Johnny was a trademark. But he lost that part of the case. Why did he lose that part of the case? There was no likelihood of confusion, right? Here's Johnny on a porta potty does not lead me to think that Johnny Carson's going to come popping out of the porta potty, right? So there's no likelihood of confusion there. There's another interesting Johnny Carson fact situation in trademark law. Johnny Carson sought to register the name Johnny Carson as a trademark with the Patent and Trademark Office. Can you register your name as a trademark? Well, you can. If he could succeed in arguing that his name was not identified with just him as an individual, but was identified with the goods and services that he renders. In other words, if the name Johnny Carson doesn't just mean the person Johnny Carson, but also means, I don't know, the whole shtick he has, then maybe he could get his trademark registered. But the Patent and Trademark Office declined. The Patent and Trademark Office said, no, you can't. Which is odd, mainly because they had permitted Lee Trevino to do exactly that. They had said Lee Trevino could get a trademark in the name Lee Trevino. I guess on the theory that his name is less associated with the person and more with the, you know, whole thing he does. I don't know. These trademark cases can be kind of close, tough ones. Okay, maybe time for just one more quick one on trade dress. Levi Jeans has a fairly distinctive stitching pattern on the back pocket. You know, there are many different ways you can stitch jeans. Some of the stitches are practical, but on Levi's and most jeans, you have stitches that are simply decorative. Well, a Spanish company thought they could maybe take advantage of that and use that, and they produced some jeans. They didn't say Levi's anywhere, but they had a similar stitching pattern on the back pocket. Is that enough for trademark infringement? Court said, yes, it is. People go out and buy jeans. They see that stitching pattern. They assume they're Levi jeans. May not even look for the label. There is a likelihood of confusion. So that was a trademark infringement. Okay, that's it for trademarks and torts. Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit us on the internet at www.teachco.com. That's teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.